Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we turn our attention to weather. Certainly, we're going to be talking about drought. We'll talk about the work of the National Weather Service with our guest, John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And, John, great to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
And our other half of our weather guys, Steve Ackerman, is flew the coop.
He's out on the road. He's in the northern part of the state, I think, talking to teachers and educators about weather and folklore and various other things. So pretty exciting trip for him, but he's indisposed.
He's indisposed, and that means that we're going to bring in somebody else afternoon.
Yeah.
We'll get Bob McMahon. I don't know if, do you know him, Bob?
I've met him once, I think, yeah.
He's a senior forecaster with the National Weather Service office in Sullivan, so we can talk a little bit with him about the National Weather Service.
You bet.
And I'm sure he'll have some comments to make about the weather as well. And, of course, you may have a question as you listen in here, and I hope you'll join us with your questions. How have you been dealing with the drought? That's one thing we can talk about with you. So give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can also, if you got some weather photos, we always love to see the weather shots, and we always get quite a few really good ones.
Mm.
So I'm hoping that we'll get some today as well. And 1-800-642-1234, the number to call, or my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. All 72 of Wisconsin counties are under a drought now?
Of one kind or another, yeah, one extremity or another. I think that's right, yeah.
And some of us have been lucky to get rain.
We're a little bit above average for the month of July in Madison. I don't know if that's true in Milwaukee or broadly across the southern part of the state, but at the airport, we're just fractionally above average after a bone dry June. So couldn't have come at a better time. I suppose it could have. It could have come 10 days earlier.
Yeah.
But in the nick of time to get us at least sustainable, maybe a little bit.
Yeah. And for the corn farmers are probably still having a lot of problems.
I think the soybeans
in time for the soybeans.
But. Yeah. The corn is mature a little earlier, isn't it? And it really needs the water earlier.
How is it decided when we're no longer dealing with a drought?
That's a good question. Somebody asked me that earlier this week, casual conversation. I think it has to do with the water table, though. That's my guess. It's not really only the amount of precipitation that you've recently received. So it probably has to do with the amount of water at certain depths beneath the top level of the soil. But I'm making a guess. Bob may know, actually, the answer to that.
And is there data for how far behind we are in usual rainfall?
Yeah, we're 4 or 5 inches behind the annual total as of July 30th at least in Dane County. So that's pretty significant.
What about the much hotter temperatures we're running this year? Certainly in the south central part of the state, we've had a lot of 90 plus.
It's remarkable. I think on the walk over here, it sure seemed to me we weren't at 90 yet, but I think we're going to get there today. And that'll be our 30th day over 90 in Madison for this summer, and
wow.
With only one day left in July, because today, of course, will count as one of those days. But the record of all time is 40 such days in 1955. And in that year, 18 of those days occurred, or 17 of those days occurred after July 31st. So there's still quite a number that could possibly come. In fact, we just had a column today in the State Journal that looks at that exact sort of statistic. In the last 41 summers, back to 1971, we've had 5 summers, including this one, where we've had 20 or more days of over 90 degrees. And the average number of days after August 1st that have been over 90 in those years, not including this one, of course, is 9.6. The largest number is 16 in 1988. So there's a better than even chance we break the all-time record, in my opinion, for the number of days over 90 this summer.
And we've even had some 100s.
We've had 4 of them. And we had 2 98s. So we're a couple of degrees short on a couple of days of having 6 100s, which would have tied the all-time record, 1936.
What are we seeing for predictions for late summer temperatures and rainfall? Is there?
I think that the late summers is expected to be a little warmer than normal. They don't give you a quantification of how much warmer than normal in those seasonal predictions. And also the tendency is looking like better than even chances of being a little drier than normal.
John Martin, our guest today, one of our weather guys, talking obviously about the drought, but other weather, answering other weather questions as well. I hope you'll join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. We'd love to hear from you. How does a dry summer, what does a dry summer, how does that impact fall and winter, or does it?
Statistically, I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question. I think it's one of those situations in which it's natural to pose the question, and if I recall correctly, and maybe I'm not, I think I've heard people ask it before, and the answer is there's not much of a statistical correlation at all between what happens in a dry summer and what that means for precipitation or temperature anomalies for the coming fall and winter. It has more to do with some physical changes that go on somewhere else in the globe. Like right now, we have a relatively cooling, in fact, ocean temperatures in the equatorial Pacific. That often leads us to a relatively drier than normal fall. And so that's a physical reason that goes a little bit beyond statistics.
And how does this cooling occur? I mean,
the ocean is a fascinating subject, and I don't know that much about it. I know that there's an interaction between the atmosphere above it and the ocean surface itself, and then cooler waters are always stored below the so-called thermocline, the subsurface
layer
of the ocean.
Comes up.
And that comes up. If you move the water across the Pacific Ocean rapidly to the west, which is normally the case, it allows the colder water to upwell. And if you slow down those easterly winds, then that allows the water to sit more or less on top of the equatorial Pacific and just warm up in the face of the sunshine. So it has to do with the winds and how they either pile water up in the West Pacific or don't pile it up in the West Pacific.
And I assume our Great Lakes, I mean, would have little or no impact on the weather itself, at least in the summertime.
They do have an impact locally. A lot of communities that live right on the lake might be wondering, what's everyone talking about these 30 days over 90? Maybe especially true on the eastern shore of the lake in the state of Michigan, because I don't know what the prevailing wind has been most of the time. But it's hard to make the lake water really warm. And so if you get a persistent either lake breeze or a large-scale circulation breeze off the water, you're not going to get to 90 degrees when places just 10 or 12 miles inland may. So it has that kind of an effect. But in terms of alleviating or prolonging drought, I don't think the lakes are really a major factor.
Don in London, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Howdy. I was just wondering, I've heard of the phenomenon called ball lightning. Is that a real thing, or is it just somebody hallucinating?
No, that's a good question. It seems like there's still some room for interpretation there. But I think, by and large, Steve knows more about lightning than I do, and I think if he were here, he'd probably agree with this, that ball lightning is pretty much an accepted phenomenon. We don't understand why it happens, but too many people have testified to it independent of one another and described the same circumstances for us to really not consider it a true phenomenon. It's hard to understand how it finds its way through, apocryphally, it finds its way through door jams, keyholes, and other such things. As it seems to be chasing people, that might be a little bit on the fable side. But it does appear to exist as a sort of some other species of electric activity in the atmosphere.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot. What does it look like, by the way?
I guess it takes various forms, but I guess one of the more common ones is that it actually looks like a ball of light, and it doesn't stay still. It kind of bounces around from one place to the other. And, there are other examples of things that have some of the same characteristics, the so-called St. Elmo's fire that can occur at the top of a mast on a ship. It's not really a lightning strike, but it's definitely a discharge of some kind, and it kind of is stationary and doesn't have a linear shape to it, sort of ellipsoidal, so it may be a cousin of this.
Hmm. Don, did you see one, or?
No, I'm hoping to someday.
Me
though.
Too.
Yeah, that would be really cool. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call very much. I'm going to have to get to our Facebook page because we already have a couple of really cool Facebook pictures, which I think I logged myself out. I'll have to try and get back in again. I'll have to get back in again. But Judith tells me there's a couple of really cool Facebook pictures that are weather related, and we'll get to that in just a minute, take a look at it. But you can probably see it right now because you can and have access to your computer. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you're going to see some really cool photos. So we'll get those up. I want to have a look at them myself. We've had some great weather photos.
I don't know if you've had a chance to go through. I do look at them, about once a week, once every 2 weeks. There are some good ones. People keep their eye to the sky around here. It's pretty exciting.
I'm wondering about tornadoes for Wisconsin this year. Are we running below normal?
That's a good question. As soon as you pose it, I wonder if we've even had any that I've heard about in the state. It's been such a weird year. I don't know if it's been zero, but it certainly hasn't been headlining news like it has been in some years. And we're sort of right in the middle of the thick of our tornado season here in Wisconsin. July and August is really about when we have a bigger risk than any other time of year. And it certainly hasn't been in the news in the month of July, and nothing to suggest it in the next 5 days leading into the first week of August. So maybe we are behind, way behind, in fact.
Yeah, I'm wondering about that. That would be... you would think with the kind of warm weather that we've had that we'd almost might be in danger of more.
Well, except that it comes along with the drought. And, of course, you need thunderstorms to have any chance of a tornado. And the prolonged period of lack of rain guarantees you don't have any clouds from which a funnel will drop. So, that's part of what's going on here. The drought's been really strongly sustained by some of the large-scale circulation features that haven't been working in our favor to produce precipitation.
Yeah, and I think the good part about it is I got my first mosquito bite.
and I had one just the other day, and I thought
I had
about
one
that.
The day before yesterday.
Yeah. I killed him before he bit me. I hope you had the same success.
No, he got me.
He landed, and I said, "What is that? I haven't seen one of them in over a year." So I killed it.
Oh, man. You can join in, too, with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Edie in DePere says, "We've had one confirmed tornado this year."
Just one. I can believe it. I have no reason to suspect that that's off the mark, because it's just, as we said, it's just been zero news about tornadoes in our state because of the prolonged drought during our peak summer season so far. So that's really interesting, just one. I don't know what the average is per year, but I'm sure it's in the dozens. I wouldn't be surprised if it is.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that we've had... We normally would have had by this time, just in southern Wisconsin, we would have at least a dozen.
You'd think, yeah, that's what I think too, yeah.
Well, I tell you what, we're talking with John Martin today. Bob McMahon's going to be joining us as well as we talk with them about the weather, about the drought, and the work of the National Weather Service. That's going to come up as well. We've got a question coming up on the Greenland ice melt from LeVon. And so, LeVon, you hang on there, because we're going to be going to take a look at the news and the weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And once again, I would urge you to go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Take a look at the photos there. There are also some links to weather-related things online, and I hope you'll do that as well. And we'll be back with John Martin, and welcome Bob McMahon to the microphones right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at weather, drought, the work of the National Weather Service, with a couple of guests. John Martin, professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, and joining us by phone, Bob McMahon, senior forecaster with the National Weather Service office in Sullivan. Bob, great to have you with us.
Great to be here, Larry. Good to talk to you and Professor Martin.
Yeah, Bob, how you doing?
Good, good.
Good.
Well, I tell you what, maybe you can start by telling us a little about the mission of the National Weather Service.
It basically comes down to, we protect lives and property by issuing forecasts and warnings for weather, hydrology, water flooding, and also for providing climate data, observational data to the public in order to prevent any adverse impact from weather as much as we can.
And how is that mission put into action? What programs do you have?
Well, our office issues the public forecast, which most people hear, sunny, high in 80, 85, something like that. But in addition to that, we also issue aviation forecasts for the airports at Madison, Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Waukesha. We also have marine responsibility for the waters of Lake Michigan from Sheboygan down to the Illinois border. We do a fire weather forecast, especially critical this time or this year with the drought that we're presently in. And we also do hydrological forecast and warnings for about 20 different river systems in southern Wisconsin. So we are the ones that issue the flood warnings when those rivers go out of bankful.
Wow. And you're a senior forecaster. What tools do you use for your work?
Well, we obviously are very computer-oriented. We have a rather robust system that we can view model data, and we have numerous models that we get both from national centers in Washington as well as some local models that we run here that help us forecast the weather. In addition, we have radar. We do have a Doppler radar here at the weather office. It's part of a network throughout the country. We have satellite and a Madison connection there. We are working with SIMS, the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, on using satellite data to help us forecast severe convection thunderstorms. So we have a variety of instrumentation that we use here, as well as our training, which we're constantly updating.
Yeah, and training. And I expect that, John, more than a few graduates from your program have wound up with the National Weather Service somewhere.
Yeah, they have. In fact, the somewhere is the important part, as Bob probably knows. We try, and any time, you know, any job across the country is open, and you've got an eager student, it's a great place to get going in that career, because I'll tell you, I have nothing but great respect for these guys. They work long hours under a lot of pressure, and they have an enormous responsibility, a responsibility that keeps growing. You know, people expect more and more out of these professionals as the tools and their own skills get better and better, and you end up demanding more from these people, guys like Bob. So it's really a remarkable career they have and a hard job that they do.
Well, we have a lot of callers with questions, and LaVon in Roberts, Wisconsin, has been waiting a long time, so let's go there. LaVon, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, thanks for talking to me. I was wondering if you would discuss the recently reported glacial ice melt on Greenland. Our paper said it covered all of Greenland, and I was wondering how many times this has happened, and what is it the warm weather that causes it, or just what is the situation?
I think the answer to what causes it is really a good question. It's still elusive. We're trying to figure that out. But as far as I understand it, it was from July, 8th to the 19th. There was an interval of time there where at the beginning of that interval, something more like what is usually the case in terms of what portion of the Greenland ice cap is actually melting. That's determined by satellite data, largely, and I'm not exactly sure how they do that, but it probably has something to do with the type of radiation that comes off the ice sheet, whether it's coated with water or whether it isn't. So that can tell them where it's melting and where it might not be melting. And then it suddenly went to the entire area of the Greenland ice sheet was in the melting state. That doesn't mean it all melted away, so that's a big distinction to make. But it does mean that it was in the process of melting at its surface. And that was unprecedented, I think, in the satellite era, at least in the last 30 or so years. And so I don't know if there's an answer about when the last time such a thing occurred, because I don't know if it's been monitored any better than it has in the last 30 years with satellites. But I think this was the first time in the satellite era that such a widespread melt was occurring. Is that about what you heard, Bob?
Yes, that is. And again, as Professor Martin said, the exact cause is really hard to pinpoint. It's hard to separate out in real time things that are just a local or current effect and one that is more long-term, more climate-based. And that is in itself an entire field of study and research in trying to separate out long-term cause versus short.
Right. Yeah.
I think suffice it to say, it would be more difficult to explain a sudden and unusual expanse of freezing during the summertime than it would be of melting. And I think that, you know, this, we know where this points. We just don't know for sure if it's part of the overall global climate change that appears to be really taking hold here in the last couple of decades after a 150-year rev up.
Levon, thanks for calling. Ron in La Crosse. Hi.
Yes, I'd like to know about whether these solar flares from the sun are affecting the weather in what way or ways.
One way in which they could, and this is only conceivable, it's hypothetical, is that a solar flare actually manifests a larger-than-average amount of energy being sent off of the corona of the sun. That's spread out over a huge part of the universe, of course, because it emanates from a sphere in the center of our solar system. Some small fraction of that extra amount of energy is absorbed by the Earth's atmosphere. And so when you take this little bit of a fraction that exists in a solar flare, and then you spread it out with a low probability of any of that energy actually hitting the atmosphere of the Earth, you probably don't have a big impact on weather as you and I think about it. Development of storms, precipitation, winds, clouds, and so on. There is some probably pronounced effect on some of the satellite communications, which is known as sort of space weather. There's a change in the electrical field and magnetic field around the Earth in response to those things, even if they're very small in scale. So I think solar flares have a bigger average impact on space weather than they do on the weather that we actually experience on the Earth's surface.
And I can verify that during part of that heightened activity when the flare reached the outer areas of the Earth's atmosphere, we did have some interruption to our satellite communications, which is the main way we distribute data from, say, the National Center in Washington out to the 122 field offices across the country. And it did interrupt communications briefly for that. It didn't affect operations, but it was noticeable.
And Bob, those are pretty well forecasted, too, aren't they, by the Weather Service's Space Weather Branch?
They are. They have a pretty good handle. There are web pages that will give you the timing and the area of the Earth that will be most affected by these pulses of higher energy coming from the sun and possible impacts. So we know they're coming. They usually either shut down or just anticipate an interruption to the satellite communication, and then it resumes after the interruption ends.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for calling, Ron. Appreciate it. Bruce in Cassville. Hi.
Hello, how are you?
Great. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Approximately 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was driving from Cassville to Prairie du Chien, and the western sky was just a huge cloud bank of blue-black clouds that looked like the raging sea out of a Winslow Homer painting. And this phenomenon was so pronounced that people who had camera equipment in their vehicles were stopping and taking photographs of it. And nothing abnormal happened after that, and it dissipated after about an hour. I wonder if anyone else has reported this, if anyone can explain what this was.
Oh,
I think I know what you're talking about. Let me see if I can. Were they sort of, you saw a lot of topography on the bottom, the underside of the cloud, right?
A great deal.
Yeah, and it's most of it was smooth shaped, though, right?
Well, on the bottom.
Yeah, scalloped on the bottom. I guess that's the right way to describe it. Oh, what was the top like?
The top was exactly what you would imagine if a giant storm blew across the ocean, and it just, you know, like almost had white caps and bluish black.
Oh, okay. So there were actually pieces of cloud that were breaking over like waves, almost the way you draw waves as a kindergarten kid.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. That's called the Kelvin-Helmholtz billows, and there's very particular characteristics of the atmosphere that have to be present for those clouds to take on that form. The underneath part of the cloud may have something to do with interaction with the high hills in that part of the state. Strong westerly flow over the hills has to be enough moisture to form the cloud, but the bottom part that looks scalloped may have been a result of some orographic effect. But the um, But the actual waves that looked like they're on the top of it are fairly rare occurrence. So you really did catch a glimpse of something that's not common, and they occur when the stratification of the atmosphere in a thin layer right about surrounding those clouds themselves and where they're breaking is low enough that you can. That the difference in wind speed across that vertical distance is enough to cause those waves to break over themselves like that. The clouds, I mean, to break over themselves like that. It's absolutely beautiful, and it can last for an hour or two, depending on how long the clouds can be sustained.
The previous time we were aware of something like that was out over Lake Michigan, either last summer or the summer before, and someone captured a picture of it. And it's exactly the way it's been described, as a series of ocean waves with the curling top. It is quite remarkable and spectacular if you happen to catch it.
Yeah. I would love to see that.
And I'm glad now everybody has some kind of phone or some kind of device that they carry in their person. I think the pictures that we're going to get, Bob, of these kind of phenomena are just going to flood. You know, the network, well, Larry's page has them. And it's great. People are paying attention. They've always paid attention to the sky, but now they have a way to capture it. So this is great.
That very fact has actually improved our operations with so many people out there. Our radar can only sense so much. We have damage reports coming in after a series of severe thunderstorms move through. Mm. And the question becomes, what is it, a tornado or was it straight-line winds? People with their video cameras, with their phones, are out there actually taking pictures of the weather as it's occurring and then sending them to us. And we used to have to go by what damage was left behind to decide what kind of storm hit. Now we have photographic evidence from a variety of sources, and it's really helped define exactly what affected a particular area.
Yeah, that's
very
really cool.
Very cool. And speaking of photos, listener Mike, on my Facebook page, there's a photo. He took this photo last summer, wants to know what kind of cloud it is. It was in the sky for at least an hour or two after the sunset. We could see lightning pulsing through the cloud.
That's a cumulonimbus cloud. I could almost remember the day I took a picture of that on my miserable phone. It has like 2 pixel resolution. I took a picture of that same cloud. And I think it was sort of, it was in our county, sort of over Fitchburg or maybe Stoughton or something like that. That's a beautiful cumulonimbus cloud. So the top part that spreads out at the top, that's where the updraft core, the air is rising in the middle of that thing, the sort of trunk of it. It's rising sometimes as much as 50 or 100 meters per second in extreme cases. This might be in the 30 to 50 range. And then it hits the tropopause, which is invisible, of course. It's just a layer, a boundary between one type of stratification and another one. It's invisible till you put a cloud mass on top, and then it spreads out like it hits a roof. Like smoke hitting the roof, and that's exactly what's going on there.
Oh.
Beautiful picture. And when they're isolated, you really can see all those different details. Beautiful.
We had that line of thunderstorms move through the other night last week, and after they had passed, with the clearing that occurred, you could look off to the east and see the line of cumulonimbus clouds. And you could see the lightning in the upper part of the cloud.
Oh, yeah.
And it was almost constant. It lit the sky for a good hour or almost two after the storm had passed.
Wow.
Awesome. Well, along similar lines, Bob, last two summers ago in Wind Lake, my son's at a baseball tournament, middle of the day, well, not middle, 2 to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, big cumulonimbus, and you could see the lightning pulsing at the top of the cloud at 3 in the afternoon. You could notice a change in the brightness. It was really awesome.
Yeah, it is quite a sight to see a very active thunderstorm when it comes to lightning and the discharge that goes on in there. It's something. And dangerous.
Yeah, that's dangerous. Very dangerous.
Daniel in Rice Lake, let's go to you. Hi, Daniel.
First, I'd like to ask, what drought? Over a month ago, when Duluth had 10 inches of rain and the area had unbelievable amounts of precipitation, what were the contributing factors to such an unusual event?
That was, I think I remember that event. I think that was one of the, it was, Bob, you correct me if I'm wrong. I think that's one of the Ring of Fire convective events, right, that you
correct.
Get in June and July. They ride the top of those flat ridges and the air is not necessarily particularly unstable, but it's inertially unstable, which is interesting. And then you can fuel these deep thunderstorms. Yeah, if you're up there in Duluth, you would be wondering what drought. It's fairly isolated and exists in different varieties as you go southward from the northern part of our state, for sure.
It's very typical of this time of year when you get thunderstorm development, unlike a winter snowstorm that covers a vast area and has, even with its heaviest snow band, can be 50, 60 miles wide, and the entire storm can cover 100 to 150 miles of width. Convection thunderstorm activity is very focused, and you can get these training echoes that develop in a situation like that, where the thunderstorms just keep popping up in the same line and traversing over the same area. And it may be only 10, 15 miles wide, but they're getting 6, 7, 8 inches
yeah.
of rain.
Yeah.
And that's where that tremendous flooding came from.
Mm. Robert in West Dallas, hi.
In West Dallas?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I was watching the radar on my computer, and I was watching a storm coming in from the northwest a week or two ago. And as it approached Milwaukee, I was looking for rain, hoping for it. But as it came closer to Milwaukee, it dissipated. The cloud dissipated. But then after it got over, it went past Lake Michigan, it picked up again. And I was wondering what caused that storm to dissipate as it approached Milwaukee. Was it high pressure? Was it the temperature of the water or what?
Bob, do you want to take a shot at that?
Given the circumstances of the time period he was talking about, one thing we look for maintaining a thunderstorm, for its strength and its continuation, are the winds aloft. And you need what we call wind shear, a change in wind speed with height, increasing with height, also a turning with height as well, but at the very least, something that will tilt the updraft and allow the thunderstorm to produce precipitation and not have that precipitation come down and kill the updraft, which was happening a lot with the isolated and scattered thunderstorms we had earlier. Mm. We just did not have the winds aloft to maintain that. I know a lot of people have said that Lake Michigan has a stabilizing influence, and that really kills off thunderstorms as they go through. But we had a storm that actually formed out over Lake Michigan and was one of the strongest storms we've ever seen on radar. And actually the atmosphere over the lake enhanced that particular storm. So more than likely, that storm weakened because that individual cell probably collapsed down on its updraft and prevented it from continuing. The reason why it would pop up on the other side is the larger scale dynamics that were in play were favorable for development of thunderstorms and more than likely, you know, redeveloped storms as that whole area shifted from west to east across the region.
Hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Thank you, Robert, for calling. Kent in Janesville. Hi.
Yeah. Couple of things. I caught a program talking about the ice caps and the weather and the drought. I got a program a number of years back, I don't know, the border of Arctic or Antarctic, of 55-gallon drums of, nuclear waste, and also the Japanese thing a little while back, and, you know, like when I was in junior high or elementary, when things go out into the ocean water, you know, the evaporation into the atmosphere. That was my question. I was wondering about that.
Can you repeat that question?
Oh, okay. Nuclear, like radiation?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like the nuclear, the thing that happened over in Japan. And then
right.
also, like, I caught a program a number of years back of 55-gallon drums, which are supposed to be put in the ground. I caught this on National Geographic magazine, how they're supposed to be lying nuclear waste in drums in the ground, but the program was that a company was putting them on the edge of, either the Arctic or Antarctic 55-gallon drums. They had a picture they actually showed the TV. But I was wondering about that, like nuclear spill or waste or, you know, the atmosphere, you know, the weather changes, the bizarre.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know I can't say anything about what's being stored on ice caps or in frozen soil. I sure hope that's not the case. And I'd say that because even without ascribing some of the breakup of the Antarctic ice to global warming, it happens whether the planet's warming or not, that ice is unstable, and especially on its edges, of course, the skirts of the ice sheet, they break up. So you don't want to be putting anything that you want to keep out of the world oceans on something that you can't even guarantee is going to stay there. I suppose the other option in the frozen parts of the world would be high-latitude land masses. But if they start to warm in the lower troposphere in the high latitudes is warming faster than anywhere else on Earth for reasons that are pretty solid. You know, once you start to get rid of ice and snow cover at those latitudes, there's more solar absorption. And so they are going to see the biggest increase in the temperature if things start to gradually warm up. You don't want to have that stuff buried in what used to be reliably frozen soil. All of a sudden it's melting away and getting slushy and who knows what else, and doing some damage to your containers. So I hope that's not the case, but it wouldn't be the first time that human beings have not used great foresight in thinking about the future.
And as far as the caller's concern about concentrations currently coming ashore or over in the atmosphere over the United States, more than likely, and I know that they were monitoring the Japanese radiation very carefully, a lot of that settled out of the atmosphere. And as far as what would be brought back up and possibly injected into the atmosphere, you're probably talking at negligible concentrations. But to reinforce what Professor Martin said, you always, always incur a problem when you have a cumulative effect, and you don't want to necessarily test that limit.
You sure don't. You surely don't. Bob, we're out of time. Thank you so much.
Well, it was a pleasure.
And, yeah, it was great having you, Bob.
Really appreciated the opportunity to talk a little bit about the Weather Service and what we do.
And we'll have you back again. We'll do it again. Bob McMahon of the National Weather Service, John Martin, Professor and Chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Of course, he'll be back as well. Stay with us.